Welcome to Guerrilla Radio on CFUV 101.9 FM, 104.3 on your cable dial, and you know we're heard around the world at cfuv.uvic.ca. Well, it's a storyline as familiar as a Roman numeraled summer sequel. Evil dictator targeting own people must be stopped. International law and order, just so much red tape. Immediate action must take precedence. Cue the Top Guns, ramp up the music. And so it was Muammar Gaddafi, a bad guy no matter which way you spell it, has seen his 42-year reign in Libya come crashing to the ground. While the Hitler of North Africa is absent his bunker, no doubt he'll be hunted down and smoked out of his spidey hole soon, and should he survive the dead or alive, but preferably dead, price put on his head, he can expect no better victor's justice than received by his evil predecessor Saddam, Hitler of Babylon, did a long drop at the end of a short rope. Another great victory for NATO and triumph for democracy. Or is it? Con Hallinan is an American educator and independent journalist. He ran the journalism program at the University of California at Santa Cruz for 23 years, where he received the UCSC Alumni Association's Distinguished Teaching Award and the University's Innovations in Teaching Award. He is also a recipient of the prestigious Project Censored Real News Award. Hallinan is currently a columnist at Foreign Policy in Focus and author of the news analysis Dispatches from the Edge, where his latest piece, Juan Cole, 10 Myths About Libya, takes on the University of Michigan professor's support of NATO intervention in Libya. Con Hallinan and getting behind the West's myths of the destruction of the Gaddafi regime in the first half. And last January, legendary journalist and author John Ross died in Mexico. Ross had reported with a rare ferocity injustice wherever he found it, never relenting, and he had the scars to prove it. I had John on the show a couple of times over the last few years, and in the second half, we'll pay him his, or at least some of his, overdue dues. John Ross, rebel to the roots in the second half. And Victoria Street News publisher and CFUV broadcaster Janine Bancroft will join us at the bottom of the hour to bring us news from the city streets and beyond. But first, Con Hallinan and a Libyan regime change rejoinder. Stick around. Well, welcome back to the program, Con.
Well, I'm glad to have me back, Chris. I'm happy to hear.
Well, my great pleasure. Now, Con, I've been critical, contemptuously so, some say, of NATO's latest invasion. My detractors say that I'm a heartless monster that would allow Colonel Gaddafi murder his own people. Should I now be contrite and jump on the victorious rebel bandwagon, Con?
I would be a little careful about jumping on that bandwagon. You're not sure exactly where it's going to go. There's an interesting piece in yesterday's Asia Times by Pepe Escobar, who writes about this region of the world. He's a particular expert on oil, and he's been tracking down some of the people who are the leading part of this transitional government's military wing, and it turns out where most of them are from is that they came out of the Mujahideen in Afghanistan and are very closely associated with Al-Qaeda, if Al-Qaeda really exists in the traditional sense of the word. But they tend to be fundamentalists. They tend to be very close to the Muslim Brotherhood. I would be a little careful about what we're celebrating here. We really don't know who these people are, and I think that your response to the invasion, which I initially called the attack of the Keystone Crusaders, was that it was not thought through and that it was a mess. I am no admirer of Muammar Gaddafi. At the same time, I think this war had a possibility of being avoided, and there was no effort to do so, and that once the French and the British and the U.S. got the United Nations Resolution 1973 passed to protect the civilian population, they immediately morphed it into regime change. And that's one of the reasons why the war went on for almost 6 months, because essentially Gaddafi was going to make it a fight to the death. It was going to be regime change, and he was being charged as a war criminal. Well, then he was going to fight to the death. One note that people should know is that there's a rumor now that he and his family are in Algeria. That's not confirmed, but or at least it wasn't confirmed the last time I saw it. But apparently he's gotten out of town at this point.
Well, I have heard about Algeria. I heard that his wife and a couple of his children were confirmed to be in Algeria, though the Algerian government was reluctant to admit that at first. As for Muammar, where he is at this hour, I don't know. But I mean, you've been around a long time, Con, and maybe not quite as long as Gaddafi, but just from reading his character and his history, do you think that he would try to go to Algeria or any other place rather than stand and fight and be buried in the sands of Libya?
You know, trying to figure out Muammar Gaddafi is, I think, more art than science, Chris. He's a very odd guy. I mean, he's an extremely odd guy. And, you know, there's no question that a lot of the things that he did, particularly in terms of opposition within Libya and things like that, were really awful. I mean, he did unleash troops on his own people. He did kill a fair number of people. But I think that, you know, when you start comparing Gaddafi with someone like Hussein, you know, who massacred vast numbers of Kurds and who, you know, absolutely liquidated any opposition from the country, I think it's a bit of a stretch. And it also, one of the things that Juan Cole does in his thing about why we should support the war in Libya is that he says, you know, Libya's always played this very sinister role in Africa, and that's just actually not factually the case. They certainly, Gaddafi certainly did encourage some in civil wars, for instance, in Chad and to a certain extent in northern Nigeria, but he also, Libya financed the formation of the African Bank, which allowed the African countries to avoid the sort of tender mercies of the International Monetary Fund and the World Bank and be able to borrow money without having to go through massive austerity cutbacks. And he also, they also funded the an African telecommunication system, which allowed the African countries to save a lot of money by not using Western telecommunications companies. Now, I'm not presenting this as, look, Gaddafi was a good guy, we overthrew this good guy. I mean, you shouldn't be in power for 42 years. You know, when you're in power for 42 years, something's wrong. But I think what I'm trying to say here is that people need to ask why Libya. I mean, why did NATO and the U.S. go into Libya? And to kind of pull the lens back a little bit and to try and see this as really a strategy that was laid out by the Heritage Foundation, which ought to scare you to death, way back in 2003, and that actually what's happened is that it's pretty much followed the recommendations of the Heritage Foundation.
And who are they, Con?
The Heritage Foundation is one of the most conservative, one of the most right-wing of the Washington think tanks. It was it is associated, it's largely funded by the Shafley Foundation and by Joseph Coors. So it gives you an idea. This is, I would say, the right of the right is the Heritage Foundation, more to the right than something like the American Enterprise Institute. They played a very important role in the Bush administration. And very early, and back in 2003, they drew up a kind of a blueprint. And the blueprint was based on the fact that the United States had to get back into Africa. And that the reason why they had to do so was because Africa was extremely rich in resources that were important, strategic to the United States, everything from rare earth elements to oil and gas. Particularly oil and gas, I mean, by 15-25% of our oil will be imported from Africa. So this is a major source now for American energy companies. And what they suggested is that, that one, the Americans form what they call an African command. People may not realize, but the United States has the world divided up into military commands. SOUTHCOM, for instance, is Latin America and the Caribbean. CENTCOM is the Middle East. You know, PACCOM is the Pacific Ocean. Then there's NORTHCOM, which is Europe, etc. But there was never a military formation for Africa. So they did. They started an organization called AFRICOM, African Command. It doesn't yet have a base in Africa because no African country will allow it to set up a base, although I think they'll get one now.
And probably in Libya, too.
And to set up this AFRICOM and then to find a place to intervene with the military, not using troops, only using airplanes and Navy, which is what the Libya intervention was, and to not do it alone, but to do it with allies. And, of course, we had the French and the British were major allies, and there were a couple of other countries that were directly involved. And the purpose was to ensure access to strategic resources, particularly since China has made an enormous kind of full-court press on trying to lock up resources in the African continent. So I think if you look at Libya in that way, and you see it as the first NATO operation in Africa, and you see it as a kind of a message to the rest of Africa, then I think you get a somewhat different strategic spin on what this war was about and also what it means for the future, which, of course, is pretty unclear at this point.
Yeah, well, I mean, we can really get easily caught up in the why Libya, why now, why Gaddafi. Well, it sounds to me that the United States and its allies in NATO, they were going into Africa regardless. What we've seen in North Africa in these last months, I don't think is quite as spontaneous and quite as people power as the press would have us believe. But I mean, this is just the next domino in taking control of Africa and her resources?
Well, I do think that that's a strong possibility, and I always have to be careful about making predictions. But I do think it's a strong possibility, and there's a kind of a track record for it. Back in 2006, the North Atlantic Treaty Organization pulled together a series of military exercises in the Gulf of Guinea, actually in the Cape Verde Islands. And the purpose of the exercise was a military intervention in case of a civil disturbance in the Gulf of Guinea, which would have an impact on oil supplies. Now, what we're talking about in the Gulf of Guinea is Nigeria, which is, of course, the largest of them, but also Angola, Equatorial Guinea. There are a number of countries that are very important in the Gulf of Guinea, and we have large amounts of oil that come out of that area. So we did this operation to sort of to war game the possible intervention. Now, if you look at the Gulf of Guinea right now, there are a number of instabilities and possible things which people should concern themselves about. The Niger Delta has a kind of an ongoing low-level guerrilla war with the Niger Delta people against the central government over the question of control of oil resources in the Nile Delta and the fact that people in the Delta are not getting any money out of the fact that all this oil is being taken out, and they also have to suffer a tremendous amount of pollution, etc. There's also a low-level guerrilla war going on in the northern part of Nigeria between the Tuareg people who are in Mali and Chad and northern Nigeria, Sahara people, over the fact that the Nigerian government has kind of put the clamps on uranium deposits, which they're mining for French uranium companies. And then there's this recent bombing, of course, that happened in the Nigerian capital, which the New York Times is talking about as being al-Qaeda-related and all this kind of stuff. And so what you're seeing here is a kind of a pattern. Back in 2000, and the United States started something called the Trans-Sahel Anti-Terrorist Initiative, and it was to train troops in the Sahara area to fight terrorism. There wasn't any terrorism in 2003. And now here we are. We're in Somalia. Mm-hmm. We're in Djibouti in the Horn of Africa. We're in Ethiopia. We're across the Red Sea in Yemen. We're now in Libya, and we have this military presence in the Gulf of Guinea. So I think what people need to ask themselves is where is this going? And just to add one small thing to that, one of the things that the Obama administration has done is that they have kind of shifted away from this idea of big military invasions and formations, Iraq, Afghanistan, etc. And they've been elevating these special forces commanders into sort of mainstream military commands in the Pentagon. So Southcom for Latin America has a bunch of special forces now. And CENTCOM, that covers the Middle East, has a bunch of special forces. AFRICOM has a bunch of special forces. Special forces, by definition, work in the dark. You know, they don't tell you what they're doing. That's why they're special forces. And so I see that there's a kind of move away from having congressional and civilian control over what our military is doing. Mm-hmm. And instead, this kind of stepping up of what I'd have to call sort of hidden warfare, the drone war in Somalia, the drone war in Yemen, the drone war in Pakistan, and now the fact that the Obama administration maintains that what we did in Libya is not a war. Certainly seems to me to be a war, but according to the administration, it's not. That's where I think people should be concerned. I think what we're doing is that we're starting to lose control over what it is that our military does, and that should concern people.
Well, yeah, and who controls the military or who is controlled by it in the United States. If you've just tuned in, you're listening to Guerrilla Radio on CFUV 101.9 FM, 104.3 on the cable, and CFUV.uvic.ca on the internet, everywhere else in Shoutcast. I'm speaking tonight with Con Hallinan, and Con is an American educator and independent journalist. He ran the program at the University of California at Santa Cruz for 20 and more years, where he received the USSC Alumni Association's Distinguished Teaching Award, and he received that university's Innovations in Teaching Award. He's also a recipient of the prestigious Project Censored Real News Award. And Con is the author of an article that's up at my website, pacificfreepress.com, called 10 Myths About Libya, or 10 Myths About Libya, rejoinder. Now, Con, before we get to Professor Cole, I wonder, you in your article, you say that the Mediterranean has become essentially NATO's lake.
Right.
Every country bordering it is either in NATO or controlled by it. I did some research a while back when looking at Gaza, Palestine, and the offshore gas fields that Israel has taken the liberty mm-hmm. of, and I looked across the whole of North Africa at rigs that were currently in the waters in the Mediterranean looking for oil or gas, but primarily gas, and what do you know? Every single country has rigs in the water. How about Libya? What's their situation? I mean, everybody's looking at the oil, but what about the gas resources?
Well, Libya has very large gas resources. I think the figure is 5 billion cubic yards. You know, that's a lot of gas. It's not anything like Iran, which is Iran and Russia have the two largest gas reserves in the world. But it's a substantial amount of gas, and there actually is a pipeline, a natural gas pipeline that goes across the Mediterranean directly to Italy. Italy is the major recipient of Libyan oil and gas. I mean, they were their colonial masters at one point. About 28% of oil and gas goes to Libya, about 15% to France, 10% to Germany, 10% to Spain, 11% to China, and then there's about 28%, which is spread out into different kinds of areas. You're quite right about the gas and oil in the Mediterranean, namely gas. The last country at this point that borders the Mediterranean that doesn't have a formal, some kind of formal relationship with NATO, either being part of NATO or else being these associations which NATO runs, is Syria. That's the last one. Mm-hmm. And there are there's a lot of tension right now between Israel and Lebanon over the question of where you draw the line for these gas reserves. And the Lebanese are saying, you know, you have to draw it here, and the Israelis are saying, no, you have to draw it here. And there's a lot of tension over that situation right there. So, you know, the U.S. Geological Survey 2 years ago, a year and a half ago, concluded that the world oil supplies had peaked. Now, there's some debate on that. There's some people who argue that isn't the case, but they make a pretty good argument for the fact that the oil reserves have now peaked. And so what we're starting to see is the slow decline of oil reserves. And when you look at the figures for North Sea oil, the Mexican oil, a lot of oil that is being pumped is, in fact, there's less of it. And there are new finds. There's a big, huge find off of Brazil, et cetera. But it does appear as if what's going to happen is that there's going to be a steady, maybe slow, but steady rise of the price of a barrel of oil. So in this case, given that this is the case, then, you know, having control of that energy high ground in the 21st century is something that, you know, any group of countries or any one particular country wants. And it's no accident that the United States is so deeply involved in the Middle East. 65% of the world's oil reserves are in the Middle East. And, you know, I find it kind of interesting that people dismiss this oil thing and they say, oh, well, you know, that's kind of, you know, that's old hat or that's sort of, you know, paranoid kinds of thing. I mean, it's really silly because, in fact, we do need oil. And if we don't get that oil, someone else is going to get that oil. And that's going to cost us more money. And one of the things that Libya did was is the fact that because oil went up, because of the Libyan war, that helped add to the economic distress in the United States. So if you're in the Obama administration, you're looking at an election in 2012, one of the things you want to do is to drive the price of oil down. I mean, that just makes common sense. And help the economy. Helping the economy means that you're going to lower the unemployment rate. Lowering the unemployment rate allows you to say we're in the midst of recovery going into the 2012 elections. I don't think the Obama administration invaded Libya because of the 2012 elections, but I know that was on some people's minds.
Well, yeah, timing is everything in these things. Well, Colin, we're fast running out of time. In the last couple of minutes, though, I want to get to your rebuttal of Professor Juan Cole. He's at the University of Michigan. He's a specialist in the Middle East, Iran primarily. His article, Top 10 Myths About the Libyan War, is the one that got you writing a rejoinder against Professor Cole's logic on this. What is it that Cole has wrong on this?
Well, you know, I kind of don't understand his article. I really was puzzled because, you know, I like Ron Cole and I read Ron Cole on a regular basis, and he's a very informed guy. And I thought of his arguments were just very odd. I mean, one of the things he says is you know, the United States went into to Libya because they support international law. But they don't support international law. And if they did, they would bring the Israelis up on charges for what they did in Operation Cast Lead in Gaza. They would demand that the same kind of criminal charges be filed against the leaders of Bahrain who've been oppressing Shiites. I mean, they're... You know, the United States supports international law when it's in its interest, and ignores it when it's not in its interest. And you don't have to be, you know, you don't have to be a critic to say that. You just look at the record. The other thing he argues is that he says that the United States, you know, has an interest in getting rid of despots. Well, listen, I'm perfectly willing to get rid of despots. But after they finish bombing Gaddafi, I assume then that the airplanes will go to Saudi Arabia and Bahrain, and, or for that matter, on to Myanmar. If we're in the business of overthrowing despots, I got a long list here. But we're not going to do that. We're not going to overthrow the monarchy in Bahrain because that's where the Fifth Fleet is parked. We're not going to take on the Israelis because Israelis are a reliable ally in the Middle East. We're not going to take on Saudi Arabia, which is one of the most reactionary countries in the world, a complete monarchy, despots, because they're our allies. So that argument, just I was amazed that, you know, that he made it. And then the last thing he argues, he says, well, we have an interest in supporting NATO. Well, it's true we have an interest in supporting NATO, but I don't have an interest in supporting NATO. I think NATO is was created to confront the Soviet Union, and the Cold War is over. And what's NATO doing in Afghanistan? What's it doing in Libya? I think this is a military formation that has no place in the modern world at this point. I don't think NATO is in the interest of the people in NATO countries. We'll have to see military spending go on when their economies are in a recession. And I don't think that they're in the interest of the countries that they occupy. So, you know, I just felt there was a series of arguments, including this one very strange one, that somehow Libya was going to destabilize Egypt. How a country of 6.2 million people is going to destabilize a country of 83 million people. I don't get that.
Well, it's
and
clear,
so
it's
when
really...
I read it, I just went through it, and I said, this is very sloppy thinking. I don't know why he wrote it, Chris. I really don't understand. He supported the initial invasion because he felt there were going to be massacres. I think his evidence is pretty thin on massacres. I think there have been some bad stuff on both sides. Again, I want to make it clear, I'm not a Gaddafi supporter. And I'm not going to lose any sleep at the fact that the man isn't running the country. On the other hand, you know, we don't know who's running the country here. And I think that, you know, he sort of, Juan Cole sort of said, well, NATO didn't really play a big role here. Well, you know, of course we did. I mean, NATO is the reason why the rebels won that war.
Well, Con, sorry to cut in there, Con, but I...
Yeah, no, I'd say you've got to go on to the next guest, yeah.
We're right out of time, but Con Hallinan, you can find his website Dispatches from the Edge. Is that .com or .org? Con? Oh. Okay, Con's not wasting any time getting off there. Okay, and do a search for Dispatches from the Edge, Con Hallinan, and you can see his stuff at Counterpunch. When I come back, I'm going to be joined by Janine, and she's going to bring us up to speed with some of the local things going on, so do stick around for that.
Welcome back to Guerrilla Radio, CFUV 101.9 FM, 104.3 on the cable, and CFUV.uvic.ca, everywhere else in Shoutcast. Joining us now, as oftentimes she does, is Janine Magroff. Hey, Janine.
And when it's over, I'm just going to hang up, Chris.
Yeah, just disappear.
did he say he had another call or something?
No, I just cut him off. And I don't know. Anyway, there you go.
Oh,
he's an old pro.
Kind of an abrupt ending there. Anyways, so are you fringing?
Yes, I've been to a couple shows, the Victoria Fringe Festival, yeah.
And what have you seen?
I saw Smart Arse a couple nights ago. This English guy whose name, the performer, I've forgotten his name, but God, was he funny. It was down at St. Anne's. Yeah. A very good show, and almost a full house. You know, big St. Anne's, that's where the piggies are, right? And they almost, it was very nearly full the night that I went.
Great.
Yeah, it was hilarious. And then I saw another thing. Oh, geez, it's an inconvenient truthiness, which was these are both one-person shows. I think most of these are, but... It was interesting and thought provoking.
I've seen a couple myself. The quality of the Fringe, you know, I know, you know, 10 or 20 years ago, I think it was sort of about, you know, the amateur thespians, and they throw something together, and not to put them down or anything, but it was, you know, they're just becoming, it's becoming more competitive, it seems, even though it's a first come, first serve, whoever gets their entry in, you know, it's not a juried process to be in the fringe. But I guess because they do actually take home all the money that people pay at the door, right? So they want to get the big crowds, and they want fringe, and all of that. So just the quality of production is unbelievable.
Mm-hmm.
I've seen three of them myself so far, and typically, if people who are new to the fringe, after this weekend, like now that the weekend is past, it will start to pick up. The lineups will get longer, and the shows may sell out as word spreads about which ones are really particularly
right.
popular and all of that. So it's best to get there early, and then, oh, and then the Fringe Club every night, 10 o'clock, they open up the Fringe Club at the Event Center. So that's a place to hang out with some of the Fringers and the people in the plays and the volunteers and all the rest of it. So that's kind of fun. And now I just want to mention that it's very sad about the hurricane, which I refuse to call these things by women's names. I think I find that particularly offensive. It's interesting, Chris, that, you know, the Japanese tsunami, we call it the Fukushima tsunami or the Japanese tsunami. Everybody knows what we're talking about. I'm not sure why we have to...
Well, to be fair, that some years ago, they alternate between male and female names.
Oh, great. So men can feel crappy, too. You
it
know,
always... Yeah, it used to be hurricanes. Now they're hurricanes as well.
Yeah, right. Great. So all humans are evil or, you know, whatever. I don't see that that's really very creative. FEMA has Twittered a very helpful safety tip. Says avoid moving water.
But does that mean don't go to the bathroom or what?
Yeah, maybe that's what it means. I know it just says, you know, that 6 inches of fast-moving flood water can knock over an adult. I mean, it seems a little obvious, but that's FEMA earning their hard, you know, their hard-earned.
Well, they're still trying to make up for Katrina, which is actually tomorrow is the sixth, believe it or not, the sixth anniversary of
the New Orleans hurricane.
That's right, the New Orleans hurricane. But which New Orleans hurricane are you talking about? And especially now when they're coming fast and furious, maybe they should be alphanumeric or like a license plates or something. But
yeah,
if you say
yeah.
the New Orleans hurricane, well, I mean, Katrina was the biggest, but they get hurricanes all the time. So how are you going to work that one out?
I don't know. We'll call a conference, and we'll talk about it, and we'll come up with something else, okay?
All right.
I think. But an unverified report suggests that the worst is over anyways on the East Coast. 5 million people without power. That's unverified, but devastating, certainly. We could call it the tar sands protest hurricane. There's a over 500 people have been arrested now. Have you been following that?
Bill McKibben, .org, he's been pushing this a lot, and I heard him on Democracy Now! Speaking something about it. Funnily, though, they never mentioned the similar pipeline that's supposed to, certain people get their way, snake across British Columbia from the tar sands right down here to the coast and the straits.
Funny you should mention that, Chris.
Oh.
There are some people starting to post about that. There is a Facebook page about it, and I think people are chatting it up. The IEN is going to be there tomorrow in D.C., the Indigenous Environmental Network, which, you know, of course, many of those are Canadian, are from this region and concerned about Enbridge. There's a press report. There was actually a demonstration at Kinder Morgan in Burnaby on the weekend. No pipelines, no tankers, no freeways, no tar sands. And so, you know, there is awareness. It's just not hitting the corporate media, of course. And the corporate media, of course, likes to call it the oil sands rather than the tar
mm-hmm.
sands. But, yeah, the Native people are definitely saying, you know, it's just not going to happen. The Enbridge pipeline isn't happening, says Chief Larry of the Nodle Wooten First Nation. And apparently the Dene Nation, who are right in that region, northern Alberta, they have also voted to oppose it. There's more than 100 First Nations in Western Canada who've said no. It's going to be interesting, certainly, to watch that. Saturday is the final day of the rally in D.C., and they're asking people to wear a black T-shirt for an aerial photograph, and they're going to Lafayette Park in front of the White House at noon till 3. And, did you hear that James Hansen was arrested?
No, I didn't hear that. He's the former NASA scientist, very prominent in the climate change debate.
Yes, he's the person who said the famous quote, if we heavily exploit the tar sands, it's essentially game over for the climate. So he went off to jail today. It's reminiscent of Clackwood, really, isn't it? It's great to see generations of people. I mean, there's all these old hippies, and then you know the younger folk as well who are taking this up. I found that there's even an international report with photos, I think from Bulgaria. I couldn't read it very well, and someone's dug up an old article from that the BBC published in 2001 about, hey, some people are suggesting this Afghan is actually about an oil pipeline.
Well, when this is what I wonder, you know, with. When the First Nations in British Columbia say they're not going to put up with it, well, I kind of think, well, what are you going to do about it? Are you prepared to become rebels like in Afghanistan? I don't know. Maybe they are, but I really doubt it. But you look at the kind of resources, millions upon billions of dollars that have been spent trying to quell the rest of Afghanis for the last 10 years so that they can run the oil through that very strategically placed country. I don't know that a few people on roadblocks is going to cut it, you know?
Well, so, yeah, it's definitely worth watching. And, you know, I'm from Northern Alberta, and you may recall, Chris, when you and I, you accompanied me to Alberta after my father passed away a few years back, and we drove out to Fort Saskatchewan where I went to high school, and that's where basically they want to start this Enbridge pipeline from Bruderheim, which is a little town near there. And I don't know, you may remember we stopped in for a beer with one of my old high school buddies there, and he's still, you know, lots of people have built their lives around this project.
Boy,
and
I wish
various subsidiary industries.
Well, I wish people could see the town you're talking about too, because it's less a town than just sort of an interruption of these massive petrochemical processing plants. I mean, these things are huge. I mean, they're just, and all lit up at night. They're rather pretty, but holy smokes, and the stink and the stench of it. Oh, geez, you can just feel yourself being poisoned just standing there. But at any rate.
Oh, well,
okay, Janine.
It is.
Well,
yeah.
we're almost out of time. I went a little long with Con in the first segment, but your show, Alternating Thursdays. No, you're not supposed to give me any warning. Alternating Thursdays, right here at 11 a.m. At CFUV, and the Victoria Street News for September is out. And I guess you're busy working on October now, right?
Oh no, I'm writing a grant actually. I'm trying
to
get some money so we can keep going for the next year, but. Thanks to everybody who's supporting the vendors out there.
Right, okay. All right, well then, Janine, and you're on the air next Thursday, right?
I'm not. I'm off into the wilds of Qualicum Beach, suburbia again there, yeah.
Oh, my God.
Well, so Rick Habgood, will be there. But actually, I'm there this week. Before I leave, I'll be there this week. And I'm trying to get a hold of someone from Alberta to talk about these tar sands. But none of my friends want to talk to me anymore.
Oh, well, you know, I'm not going to make a comment on that. But do as they say on the CBC, out there in the retirement land where the hippies are actually the people that have survived a hip replacement surgery.
Oh, I'll bring my Valium.
Valley of the Dolls. Okay, well, thanks a lot, Janine, and until the next time then.
Thank you, Chris.
All right, bye-bye. Now I'm going to take another brief break, and I'm going to play. This guy is just so cool. I just can't believe it. And a lot of you know him, I'm sure, but this is Canadian chappy. No relation. Jessica. We'll be right back.
fantastic. Jesse Cook from his disc, The Ultimate Jesse Cook, title of that tune is Baghdad. Well, John Ross was an American journalist, poet, and author who lived in and reported from Mexico for more than three decades. Some of his many book titles include The Annexation of Mexico from the Aztecs to the IMF, One Reporter's Journey Through History, Mexico in Focus, A Guide to the People, Politics, and Culture, and his American Books Award-winning From the Roots, Indian Uprising in Chiapas, and Zapatista, Making Another World Possible, Chronicles 2000 to 2006. John Ross died last January in his beloved Mexico. I had a couple of opportunities to talk to John over the years, and before getting to our last chat, here's some of what his friend Tim Redmond, a colleague at the San Francisco Bay Guardian, had to say about him. Quote, when John Ross left Terminal Island, the federal prison in Los Angeles, after serving a couple of years for refusing the Vietnam draft, the warden shook his head and said, Ross, you never learned how to be a prisoner. Well, I'm not writing the epitaph for whatever gravestone he has or doesn't have, wherever it might be in the world, but that's what I'd put on it. John Ross, 1938 to 2011, never learned how to be a prisoner. John was a poet, author, activist, agitator, and uncontrollable shit disturber, utterly and sometimes insanely fearless, pure of heart, and devoted to the cause of social justice so deeply that he could never let up, even for a minute. He was also my friend, and end quote. And that's from Tim Redmond, who worked with John Ross at the Bay Guardian in San Francisco. I spoke to John for the last time in August of 2008, and here's a bit of that interview here.
Ma'am, John.
Hey, how you doing, Chris?
I'm doing all right. It's a beautiful, almost Mexican-like day up here in the Northwest. But, John, we're seeing a more muscular approach to U.S. policy in both Mexico and across Latin America. What's behind this this revitalized approach to the South?
Good question. I think that a lot of that may have to do with the U.S. election, to tell you the truth. The Bush administration wants to leave something behind after completely forgetting about Latin America for a number of years, and has revived what you described accurately as a muscular policy in the region. And I think they want to get this in place before an Obama is elected. If a McCain is elected, he's a Navy guy, so he's going to be, I think, greatly in favor of employing a fourth fleet to keep Latin America in line.
Well, of course, Bush Sr., while he was president and as he was the effective president, as Reagan's vice president, was very much involved with Latin America, and most disturbingly so, as some of our older listeners may remember. Do you think that this is the influence of the Bush-Pair administration and some of the same personnel that Bush Jr. has taken on that is thinking it's time to revisit South America?
I'm not so sure, but it is an interesting coincidence that one of the ships that will be used in the revived Fourth Fleet, there's 11 more ships in the fleet, is, well, it's not confirmed yet, and indeed the aircraft carrier is not being commissioned, is a George H.W. Bush, and that will be homeported at Mayport in Jacksonville, Florida, which is where the Fourth Fleet will be drawn from. The Fourth Fleet is not a standing fleet. It's drawn from the ships that are at that are ported at in Jacksonville.
Yeah, well, now, you in your article, you talk about the Admiralty and their opinion, and one comment specifically is that, you know, this, I'm paraphrasing, but saying, well, this deployment will really, you know, show those other navies in the Caribbean and on the Atlantic seaboard what's what. A rather taunting.
I thought that was a curious statement. You know, it smacks of the Monroe Doctrine. No, and are we? Is it a reference to, in fact, the navies of Latin America, or is it a reference to the possibility that other non-American nations will be cruising in those same waters, which is, in a real sense, in the Fourth Fleet, it's always reminiscent of those years of gunboat diplomacy that were justified by this obscure document issued in 1823, the Monroe Doctrine, that said, everybody else stay out of Latin America. Latin America is the U.S.
So. Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, now, recently, in recent years, we've seen, especially through Venezuela's Hugo Chavez, that the introduction into that lake the Chinese interest and Chinese shipping, presumably, to follow the deals that have been signed for Venezuelan oil. Is this perhaps what the American Navy is going on about, trying to put one across the bow of the Chinese?
Well, you know, it's a strategic decision, you know, and you take these decisions by saying this is an area in which we are losing our hegemony, and how can we retain that, and how can we bolster that? And deploying the Fourth Fleet to the Latin American coastlines, and confined, basically, the Fourth Fleet has traditionally been confined to the Atlantic side, is one way of reinforcing reinforcing what was and will never be again. The Bush administration lost sight of Latin America. I don't want to say the Bush administration lost Latin America, because it really wasn't theirs to lose, but it did certainly lose sight of Latin America. Power in the world runs on an east-west bias. The Bush administration has been obsessed with the Middle East for the last 8 years. And during that period of time, what was very natural and to be anticipated, the pendulum swung left. Neoliberalism didn't meet the needs of the people. They go to work in the morning, and the buses and the transportation cost more, and they lost their phone companies, and they lost their health care, and they lost all social services that were at one time, at least a modicum of which were at one time, provided for them in this massive wave of privatization. And it was to be anticipated that that pendulum would swing to the left, and swung to the left basically to social democratic electoral parties. That, you know, pretty much, if you look at the map of Latin America now, if you're going to color the left in red, it's pretty much a red map.
Well, not entirely. Of course, there's still Colombia there, which is as blue can be, if blue is going to be the counter color to red. Now, I know that amongst other things that the Bush administration might have lost sight of and lost, they're about to lose one of their half dozen naval bases in Latin America, and there's no indication that there might not be more to follow. So they've decided to set up another base in Colombia in the south, right next door to Hugo Chavez. How are the Venezuelans reacting to the prospect, the rumored prospect of this new base?
Hugo was not very happy. He called it an act of war when the Admiral Ruffhead of the Fourth Fleet announced that the fleet was being reactivated. All around Latin America, the reactions of governments, basically governments on the left now, it was not very good. The State Department sent Tom Shannon, the Undersecretary of State for Hemispheric Affairs, on a tour of Latin America to try and convince leaders that this was a great idea and be in their interest to protect shipping lanes, it would be really good for drug interdiction and all of this stuff. He got to Brazil. There were big demonstrations in Brasilia, and when the concept of the reactivation of Fourth Fleet was put on the floor of the Brazilian Senate, there was a rebellion. One senator reminded his colleagues of 1964, when in fact Fourth Fleet was stationed off of Brazil, and invasion was threatened if a left-leaning president, João Goulart, did not resign. Those are the kind of memories that people have. The Fourth Fleet invokes memories of, we talked about the Caribbean as an American lake, where the Fourth Fleet was homeported on the island of Santo Domingo, which was a strategic point from which you could operate throughout the Caribbean, and invaded, carried the Marines and invaded Nicaragua, 14 times between 1914 and 1927? So, you know, there, the memories of what was in Latin America weigh a whole lot. You know, the imperialism has left its scars and it's left its memories, and indeed the resistance of the people keeps those memories alive.
Well, and you know, I guess when it comes to memory and amnesia, it's a lot easier to remember when you're on the receiving end of the stick, you know, to remember what had happened. And these imperial operators, they seem to have a convenient sense of amnesia where they can walk away from one, like Nicaragua, as you imagine. More recent memory might be the mining of the harbors and the usurping of the left-leaning government there under Ronald Reagan. And when you mention the H.W. Bush as being the flagship of this Fourth Fleet, I can't help but wonder how that little bit of irony is received in Latin America as well.
Yeah, it is in a real sense, it is an offensive action. It is a provocative action, and it can come to no good. Let me put it that way. Bush administration has been notoriously short-sighted in everything that's done over the last 8 years, and one might ask themselves if this is just some last desperate move on their part to, again, reassert their hegemony in Latin America. But the question is who, what comes next? And indeed, if things go the way people say they're going, I don't know, I live in Mexico, so I just hear rumors of elections in the United States, we'll certainly have a new president in November, and that new president will most likely be Barack Obama. And it is in the Bush administration's interest, and those ideologues, such as Cheney and the gang all around him, to put in place these policies and these strategic initiatives so that they will have to be, they will certainly be inherited by Barack Obama, and given his vacillation in one area of foreign policy after another, one would think that they have a good chance of surviving.
Well, if you've just tuned in, you're listening to Guerrilla Radio on CFUV 101.9 FM in Victoria, 104.3 on the cable, and cfuv.uvic.ca around the world in Shoutcast on the Internet. I'm speaking tonight with John Ross, and John Ross is an American journalist, poet, and author who's lived in and reported from Mexico for more than three decades, and some of his book titles include The Annexation of Mexico, From the Aztecs to the IMF, One Reporter's Journey Through History, Mexico in Focus, A Guide to the People, Politics, and Culture, and his latest book is Zapatista, Making Another World Possible, Chronicles 2000 to 2006. John, about the Zapatistas now.
Well, no, I think that's as good a place as any to leave off with John Ross. He's sadly passed in January at the age of 72 down in Mexico, where he had lived and reported from for so long and did so much for the indigenous people there. Look him up and look up his books. You can hear the rest of that article at my website, pacificfreepress.com. Just go to the top, to the Guerrilla Radio tags, where you'll, after a little bit of scrolling through a few pages, because there's several, I don't know how many now, more than 100 anyway, past interviews from this show up there, a lot of interesting stuff too. And his is one of those that I salvaged and reposted to, as a standalone, John Ross Presente. And thanks to Con Hallinan, especially for coming on at such a last-minute notice for me. Always tough time to book acts, or guests, I should say. Too much fringing for me. Get out and check it out, as Janine mentions. Thanks, of course, to Janine and all the folks up here at the radio station that keep things going week in and week out. And that's, I'm going to leave you again with Jesse Cook's Baghdad from his Ultimate Jesse Cook disc. And remind you, especially jazz lovers, to stick around, because I may be finished, but the show goes on. Arnold's coming straight up with Rhythm and Ink to jazz you into this beautiful late summer evening here in Victoria. Until the next time.